Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 45, The Cathars Part 3, Cicely D'Altremont, American Cathar. Today I'm recording from the lovely campus of the Catholic University of America. Alright, so allow me to revisit that dissertation that I kept bringing up last episode. I will now read from the introduction again, entitled, Two Cistercian Preaching Missions to the Languedoc in the 12th Century, 1145 and 1178, by Cicely D'Altremont Angleton. A dissertation submitted to the faculty of the School of Arts and Sciences of the Catholic University of America, in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree Doctor of Philosophy. Cicely D'Altremont Angleton, Washington, D.C., 1984. Dedicated to the memory of Deodat Rocher. Preface. This dissertation focuses on the missions of Bernard of Clairvaux and Henry of Marcy in the Languedoc in 1145 and 1178, respectively. Historians agree that the missions failed in their goal to eliminate or slow down the progress of the heresy. From a limited point of view, they are correct. The missions were indeed unsuccessful. In the long run, however, the efforts of Bernard and Henry of Marcy did bear fruit. They were an influential factor in the general development of ecclesiastical policies toward heresy in the Languedoc in the second half of the 12th century, as well as in aiding in the establishment of a strong Cistercian presence in southern France. Acknowledgements, professors, typists, etc. Above all, my husband and children have given me warm support and loyal encouragement, which never wavered in spite of their bad jokes and raffish teasing, patiently endured for the sake of eternal fame. Unquote. Now, in case you didn't catch that, the dissertation that I have been using was written by Cicely D'Altremont Angleton, the loyal wife of James Jesus Angleton, Director of Counterintelligence at the Central Intelligence Agency. She dedicated the dissertation to the memory of Deodat Rocher, the Martinist cum Gnostic Church cum Freemason cum Anthroposophist cum Cathar scholar. The same guy that we talked about, who started that Cathar Remembrance and Study Society, which was shoddy and ahistorical Cathar research, being leveraged into the esoteric grist for the occult mill. The very same Rocher who knew Maurice Magre, Simone Weil, and Otto Rahn. Rahn, the occult investigator for Heinrich Himmler. The very same Rahn who wrote Lucifer's Court. Now, the inevitable question, did Cicely D'Altremont Angleton meet Rocher? Well, in fact, that is itself a very interesting question, but before we get to answering it, let's introduce Cicely D'Altremont Angleton formally and go through some of her life to lead to that question. And to truly understand someone, you need to know their family history, right? Tell me who your mother and father and grandparents are, what they did, how they made a living, and I will tell you who you are. Cicely Harriet D'Altremont was born in Duluth, Minnesota in 1922. Her family was loaded on both sides. Her father's side were old French wealth tied up in the DuPont circle. Her grandfather, Charles D'Altremont, went to Cornell and then Columbia Law School. Then he got into mining interests. It was this grandfather, Charles D'Altremont, who surveyed the Mesaba Iron Range in northern Minnesota, and who went on to become the director of the Calumet and Arizona Mining Company. When Cicely's father, Hubert D'Altremont, married her mother, Helen Congdon, it was described as a joining together of Duluth's two most powerful families. Cicely's father Hubert was a banker. Now, I am certain that the D'Autremont family got up to some very interesting things, but I found a lot more on the Congdon family. By the way, if someone's family history includes a Congdon in it, I would be very wary about listening to what they have to say about parapolitics. Just a little rule of thumb that I created. I call it the Congdon rule. So, Tom Mangold, whose book I will cite later on, wrote about Cicely Ingaldon. Her grandfather, Chester Congdon, created the family's fortune mainly from mining and lumber, and by the turn of the century, the Congdons were one of the richest families in Duluth. Unquote. Side note, that would be one of the richest families in Minnesota, right? The Congdon family were old, old wasps, and like the Congdon family came from the Quakers, which is itself a form of heresy if you think about it. The Congdons settled in Providence, Rhode Island, back in the 17th century. Interesting place, interesting time. Chester Adgate Congdon, the relevant Congdon here, he became a lawyer. That's not necessarily surprising, but it is interesting because C. Wright Mill, in his seminal book called The Power Elite, he explained how you actually become rich in the United States. And I quote, "Very few of those who have risen to great wealth have spent the major portions of their working lives steadily advancing from one position to another within and between the corporate hierarchies. Such a long crawl was made by only 6% of the very rich in 1900 and 14% in 1950. But even these who apparently did move slowly up the corporate hierarchy seem rarely to have made the grade because of talents in business management. More often, such talents as they possessed were the talents of the lawyer, or very infrequently, those of the industrial inventor." Unquote. For a long time in the United States, you were not likely to become rich through hard work. No, you pretty much needed to become a lawyer. That's what Chester Adgate Congdon did. As the author Mangold said, Congdon got rich through mining and lumber. But even that is misleading, right? Because A, the Congdons were already rich, and B, it's not like Congdon was himself a miner or a lumberjack. No, Congdon was general counsel and sat on many boards of many different mining and lumber companies. Specifically, Congdon was general counsel for the Oliver Mining Company, which worked on the Mesabi Iron Range in northern Minnesota, like we were saying. The miners there were largely Finnish, Italians, and Southern Slavs, all mostly immigrants. These workers had been organized by the Western Federation of Miners. One of my favorite historical unions, by the way. That union had been invited at the behest of Finnish socialist immigrants. The Western Federation of Miners organized 14 different locals, and they all went on strike after a layoff in July of 1907. The Oliver Mining Company brought in scabs and gun thugs who broke the strike, though there was not much violence. In 1916, the workers did a walk-off and started another strike, this time led by the Industrial Workers of the World. Elizabeth Gurney Flynn was one of the Wobblies brought in to help organize the strike. In the case of the 1916 strike, many of the former scabs were actually tired of the conditions and were among the strikers. As the mines were already filled with former scabs, there were not many more scabs to be had. So violence was to be the order of the day. They jailed union leaders illegally, the mining company leaned on merchants extending credit to the strikers, and the company refused to negotiate with strikers. The gun thugs fired on workers and killed one. Ultimately, this strike was also crushed, although they did win some short-term goals. But, for the most part, the mining company otherwise crushed and prevented there from being a union. As general counsel for the company, Congdon would have absolutely been in the mix on at least the first strike, though he would die in 1916, so he may not have participated much in the second strike. Which, speaking of, Congdon was also a director of the Calumet and Arizona Mining Company of Bisbee, Arizona. Bisbee, specifically with the Phelps Dodge Company, would carry out the infamous Bisbee deportations in 1917. Now, in relation to the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, which Congdon also had a hand in, there were copper mines in Michigan, and when the workers went on strike there in 1913, their demands included an 8-hour workday, a minimum wage, and several safety demands. In response to this strike, several workers were murdered. And in response, also, the mining company called in the Michigan National Guard, who forced the miners to go back to work. In relation, and probably retribution, on Christmas Eve 1913, the Western Federation of Miners were holding a Christmas party at a local Italian Benevolent Society hall in Calumet when someone shouted fire, causing 73 people, including 62 children, to be crushed to death. Congdon was elected to the Minnesota House of Representatives, where he would vote against a tonnage tax, which is to say, lumber and mining, to the things that would be most impacted by a tonnage tax. Right? So he represented lumber and mining, he voted against the tonnage tax, and it paid off greatly for his mining and lumber interests. Congdon also voted for limitations on strikes, surprise, surprise, increased benefits and pay to policemen, surprise, surprise. He voted against ending child labor. There's a great quote from a muckraker journalist about Congdon saying, quote, "He sacrificed all his fine qualities to corporate interests," unquote. So you see, the way to get rich in America is not through hard work, it's by becoming a lawyer and then helping mining and lumber companies do some fucked up shit like crushing strikes through illegal and extra legal means, up to and including murder, then leveraging that into politics where you vote for things that increase your bottom line. That is why Cicely Harriet Dautremont was rich enough to be sent off to Vassar to fuck around and study French poetry. Also, I might as well just say it, because fuck him, right? Brace Belden, also a Congdon. Go figure. So, Cicely Dautremont grew up in Minnesota and Arizona due to her father's mining interests. She studied English and French at Vassar, like I said. In that day, Vassar was still a women's college, right? As the story goes, Cicely was actually on a date with a boy from Yale, and this boy wanted her to meet his friend and roommate studying at Harvard Law School. So they went up to this boy's apartment, where there was, in the living room, a large reproduction of El Greco's painting, View of Toledo. In the room, standing next to the painting, was her future husband, James Jesus Angleton. What a meet cute, right? Reportedly, he opened with, "How do?" To quote Cicely here, she said, "There was nothing in the room except a large reproduction of El Greco's View of Toledo. It showed a huge, unearthly green sky. Jim was standing underneath the picture. If anything went together, it was him and the picture. I fell madly in love at first sight. I'd never met anyone like him in my life. He was so charismatic. It was as if the lightning in the picture had suddenly struck me. He had an El Greco face. It was extraordinary," unquote. Cicely would write a poem of that meeting. I will read it later. Which, like, listen, man, the heart wants what it wants. And respect to her for getting all worked up. Like, that's cool, right? But, like, I encourage you, dear listener, to look up a picture of the young James Jesus Angleton. It's amazing. He looks basically like Adam Friedland from Come Down. Or, like, literally, he just looks like any dude. Which, I mean, hey, man, go for it, I guess. But nevertheless, Cicely was way, way into him. She would say, in fact, Jim was a Chicano, and I loved him for it. I never saw anyone as Mexican as he was. He was Latino and Apache. He was a gut fighter. Unquote. Which, again, I'm not going to argue here, but it's the horniest, most insane thing I've ever heard. Like, have you ever seen a Mexican? Like, she lived in Arizona. Of course she did. James Jesus Angleton's mom was Mexican. And like, no, I'm not, you know, trying to be the Latino understander or to break out the calipers here, but like, Angleton's mom didn't exactly tiene el nopal en la frente, if you catch my drift. So like, I don't know what she's talking about. So Cicely and James, they shared a deep interest in poetry. They would each correspond with various poets. Like, I know specifically that Cicely corresponded with E.E. Cummings, and I think James Jesus Angleton corresponded with many more poets. I don't think I know. I just don't have... We'll talk about that next episode. So, Cicely and James dated for a time, and then they got engaged in April 1943, after Angleton was drafted into the army. They were married in July of 1943. In August of 1944, Cicely gave birth to their first child, while James Jesus Angleton was overseas, serving in Europe. He would not come back until November 1945, and reportedly, their marriage was on the rocks. Angleton would, many years later, confide to a friend, that rarest of things for him to do. He said that he felt guilty about leaving his wife alone in order to become a spy. Quote, "I left Cicely at home with our first child to do this work. I felt guilty about it." Unquote. Angleton would also say of his wartime service, quote, "Once I met Philby," as in Kim Philby, "the world of intelligence that had once interested me consumed me. The home life that had seemed so important faded in importance." Unquote. Cicely's first cousin once removed, who did, you know, observe these events, said that Cicely had actually sent James divorce papers at one point, but he refused to sign them. She filed for divorce in June of 1946, but stopped the proceedings when she found out she was pregnant again. Cicely would say, "We just didn't know each other anymore. Jim was wishing we were not married, but he was too nice to say it. He thought the situation was hopeless. He was all cut up in his career. We had both changed. He was typical of a war marriage. It was exactly what his father had warned us about in 1943. Jim no longer cared about our relationship. He just wanted to get back to Italy, back to the life he knew and loved. He didn't want a family. The marriage seemed to be annihilated then and there." Cicely graduated from Vassar in 1947. When Angleton came back to the United States, he joined the Central Intelligence Agency and moved their family to Washington, D.C. The Angletons bought a four-bedroom home in North Arlington. Guess where the home was? The home was located on 33rd Road. Good stuff. There's a great quote from Cicely bitching to one of her friends about spies in general, and this remark is occasioned by Angleton's trip to several CIA stations across Europe. She said, "Really, the hush-hush men deserve little pity, and this isn't even considered a vacation." The Angletons, now together, patched up their marriage, I suppose. They fell into an elite circle of spooks, top bureaucrats, politicians, journalists, artists, and socialites. What a weird mix, right? They definitely don't all seem to be in the same social class. I'm being facetious. The Georgetown set, as it was called. Various people referred to Cicely Angleton as not socially ambitious. Now, for the spooks, we are talking about Frank Wisner, head of special operations, think Iran 1953, Guatemala 1954. Wisner would eventually be the second director of the CIA after Allen Dulles. There was Tracy Barnes, who oversaw the Guatemalan coup and the Bay of Pigs. There was Frederick Wistar Morris Janney and Desmond Fitzgerald, both CIA officers. There was Richard Bissell, who worked in the Ford Foundation. And then, as a CIA officer, he would be Deputy Director of Plans. Shout out to the Bissell I know, who is related to Richard Bissell. I know him off Twitter and through these paranoid circles. For the bureaucrats and politicians, there was Chip Bolin at the State Department, one of the famous wise men. There was Eugene Rostow, who served in the cabinets of LBJ and Reagan. There was Walt Rostow, I think his brother, who was one of LBJ's national security advisors. Clark Clifford, who was involved in four different presidential cabinets, also wrapped up in the BCCI scandal. There was Paul Nitz, who founded Team B for the CIA. Like, major players, right? There was Philip and Catherine Graham, who owned the Washington Post. You know, like that dog shit movie where Meryl Streep plays Catherine Graham. Good stuff. The whole Watergate thing, right? Also in this circle was Ben Bradley of the Washington Post. Also Joseph Alsop, the journalist and columnist. Officially in both camps was Thomas Braden, a CIA officer who also started the TV show Crossfire. There was James Truett, who worked for Life and Time magazine and then ran Newsweek, along with his wife, Ann Truett, the quote-unquote famous sculptor. And then there was the power couple, Cord Meyer, a CIA officer, and Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was an artist, a painter specifically. In Nina Burleigh's very well-researched book, A Very Private Woman, the author wrote, "The younger families, like the Meyers, Jannies, Truetts, Pittmans, Lannans, and Angletons, spent a great deal of leisure time together. There were evening get-togethers, and sometimes the families took weekend camping trips to nearby beaches or mountains when husbands could get away. On Saturday mornings in the fall, the adults got together and played touch football in a park north of Georgetown, while their children biked around the sidelines, then all retired to someone's house for lunch and drinks. The Jannies had a pool, and on hot summer nights, the parties were loud, drunken affairs, filled with laughter, dancing, and the sound of breaking glass and people being pushed into pools." Unquote. Cicely Angleton was particularly close to Mary Pinchot Meyer and Ann Truett, both artists, as I said. Cicely Angleton called Mary Pinchot Meyer her best friend, in fact. Mary Pinchot Meyer had an affair with John F. Kennedy, and Meyer was in all likelihood murdered by the CIA. Cicely Angleton called her husband at work, which she very rarely did, when she found out that Mary had been murdered, and James Jesus Angleton rushed over to Meyer's house to retrieve her diary. This is very well documented in several books. It's crazy, right? Because the Angletons, including Cicely, they knew Kim Philby. They knew other people in the Cambridge Five. They would have them over for dinner. They knew William Harvey, the Kennedys. They frequently dined a little later on in their lives with, like, top Israeli intelligence. It's interesting to think about. On a lighter note, I have a quote from someone in the Dautremont family. I believe this would be Cicely's cousin once removed. She said, "Cicely Dautremont was my mother's first cousin. She was dazzling. Cicely was our Catherine Hepburn, the family bohemian who got her PhD in medieval French history, and was known for attending a Washington soiree in Balenciaga gown and tennis shoes. Cicely was hugely wealthy. She and Jim had three children. I've never understood how or why the marriage held together. Jim's job meant that when the job demanded it, he would simply disappear. Cicely did not know where he was or when he would return. The only reason I can think that they remained together was because each was the most brilliant person the other knew, and probably no one else would have put up with either of them." Unquote. Which, of course, I'm an outsider, but I have spent way too much time thinking about the Angletons, and that seems like an accurate assessment to me. They remained together because they intellectually respected each other and no one else would stand each other. Sounds right. And To be sure, the Angletons did appear to have some good times. Cicely enjoyed their family vacations in Arizona and Wisconsin, where they would go camping and fly fish. Still, Cicely would say, "It was a struggle, a terribly long struggle, to keep your family together, and yourself together, and your husband together, in the Cold War, in the CIA. It was one of the great traumas that I had. It was something you had to wrestle with all the time." So, as James Jesus Angleton was becoming the Hulk Hogan of counterintelligence, their marriage was on the rocks. Like, their marriage was apparently always on the rocks, it kind of seemed like. At no point did their marriage seem to be going well. One of the Georgetown set, Frederick Wistar Morris Janney, said, "I always had the impression that Cicely Angleton was somehow underwater. By that, I mean she was not terribly happy with her family and her family life." Nina Burley, the author, interviewed a Kennedy White House secretary named Letitia Baldridge, who talked about the unique strain the CIA had on relationships. "If you had a husband working for the CIA, you learned to become a specialist in medieval art or gardening or something, so you had your own life, because your husband would not talk to you." Unquote. Now, it's likely that she was thinking specifically about women in the Georgetown set when she said that, and possibly even Cicely in particular, because that is exactly what Cicely did. She worked towards getting a PhD in medieval history. To that end, she went to southern France to study. She was there for a whole summer in 1962. "I confirmed this with the Angleton family." That's right. I was talking to James Jesus Angleton's daughters, the ones that converted to the Sikh religion. They said, and I couldn't find this anywhere, but I heard it right from their daughters, that Cicely did in fact study in France in 1962. And, in fact, that Cicely Angleton studied with Deodat Rocher there in France. Now, Cicely Angleton would not complete her PhD until 1984, however. Now, separate from this, I also found an old Library of Congress series of poetry podcasts, which interviewed Cicely Angleton, where she described her time in southern France as a pilgrimage, which is a very curious thing to say. So, Cicely Angleton wrote poetry. I have in my hand a book of her poetry entitled A Cave of Overwhelming. I bought this book online, and to my surprise, I found that she had actually signed this copy that I bought, which was very fun to see. So, I would like to walk you through several of Cicely Angleton's poems. You know, people might accuse me of reading into things, but when it comes to poetry and, I don't know, espionage, I think that a little reading into things is probably warranted, right? So, in some cases, I will read the entire poem. In other cases, I will read a selection. So I will read half of this poem, entitled Erosions, which speaks of her family, and, for lack of a better term, their family trauma. "Our family wrapped their grief in heavy parcels, covered with newspaper from the First World War, jerked them with cords, then stacked the packages down in the basement under the billiard table, or piled them in the attic next to the headless torso that terrified new friends who came to play with us. On sad occasions, a ball of string was always rolling, and fish hooks sealed our eyes." That line recurs several times in the poem, "and fish hooks sealed our eyes." The next poem, I suspect, is addressed to her dead husband, and is titled The Revenant, in case that wasn't clear. "Once you claimed insurance companies predict an average of 8 years of widowhood. Now you ask, am I enjoying them? Honey, be serious. My days are hemmed together in such even seams they look like linen sheets. Nights on this great big square deserted slab, I count the feathers in my pillow, dream of dead Egyptian kings, stuffed with alabaster plugs in every orifice. But let me ask you, if we could revive the rich disorder of our lives, broken chariots and eyes outlined in black upon the wall, would either of us return? Your silence is disturbing. You're not the only one who can adjust to change. Cicely Angleton also wrote a poem called A Weaver's Song, but other than it touching upon weavers in medieval Europe, I couldn't really perceive there to be that much insight into either her family or the Cathars. Still interesting, but here is the poem about her first meeting James Jesus Angleton, entitled First Sight. One rainy day on Brattle Street, my weekend date walked me up three flights of narrow stairs to meet his college roommate. At the long end of a barely finished room, "How do?" the young Chicano said politely, melting from El Greco's stormy painting of Toledo, before he disappeared again. I fell right through the creaky floorboards, through damp roses wired to the sidewalk, past St. Teresa's plaster statue in the garden. Beware, she warned, of hollow cheeks and auras sketched in lightning that bounced me up again. Hello, I say, or didn't say. I feel like I want to be like, and scene, at the end of these poems, and scene. Here's a poem which is ambiguous, yet full of ominous portent. It's called In Loco Parentis. Name, ask the dictionary in a kindly tone, peering through his glasses at the applicant. Asterisk, your honor, if you please. In English, it means little star, Greek, I believe. I'm aware of that. Your place of origin? At the bottom of the page, that's what they tell me, sir. Just answer the questions. Family? My father was a footnote, a most impressive character. When he was sober, you might say he suffered from a multiple personality disorder. Confidential information. Completely confidential, said the dictionary, scribbling on his notepad. And your mother? My mom, she wasn't there most of the time, kind of floated in and out of words, if you get my meaning. Indeed, known as an omission. Were you close? Closer than these rays upon my head, declared the little asterisk. Her secret sin called me, her little indication, fondly, you know, as mothers will. I understand. Why do you want to join the company? Personal reason, sir. It's important to belong. You're an understanding sort of chap. With my family history, you wouldn't risk your ass. Watch your language, son. You're out of line. Yes, sir, I always am. The dictionary fiddled with his pencil. Well, we'll include you. Put you with the A's. Bring us a photograph and polish up your rays. So you see, it's like playful and yet touching on some interesting ideas. Here's a poem called To Faustus. Come on, old friend, let's strike a bargain. Helen waits for you in Ilium. I'll sell you my car, and you can buy a quick parole from Mephistopheles and practice magic with computer chips. So many souls on the exchange these days. He's broke and needs the cash. Retrieve your vision, and in return, transform me into a pink cliff reflecting sunrise. Someplace in northern Arizona, where thunderheads herd sheep and rattlesnakes hunt in moonlight. Not my hometown, high on a starry lake, where a paralyzed old lady was smothered for a sapphire on her finger. At night, all cats are gray. I want time out, time to change my blood for sedimentary veins within a rock, lava or sandstone, until the term expires. Come visit me. There, you see, I haven't quite accepted metamorphosis, and you might find more magic than you ever learned since Wittenberg. Just, you know, poems about making deals with the devil. It's all cool. It's all good. Now, here's a poem called A Benediction, and it is very hard not to read this one as being about their marriage. Now blessings on all bad husbands, while one drop of charity remains in me. quick before the hot wind blows from the south. This poem, called Umbra, I suspect, may be about the death of her husband. I have seen moonlight still the alders on the river, balsam and cedar, maple and white pine, and solanar tables warn that a full moon keeps brown and rainbow trout from feeding on clouds of mayflies rising from the hatch. So fishermen stay home at night to patch their rubber waders, drink whiskey and tie flies of gossamer on steel hooks almost invisible. But one late August night we anchored our canoe beneath a meteor-deserted sky to watch a full eclipse. The sentient air was free of mayflies, and no bird called from either side when shadow blotted out the moon, as quietly and irreversibly as once I saw a dying man stop breathing. Cicely D'Autremont Harriet Angleton would pass away in 2011. So what are we to make of all this? Like, what have I even established here? That Cicely D'Autremont Angleton's family were evil lawyers and mining fat cats who bathed in the blood of workers? Yes, I think so. And that those family fortunes allowed her to study at Vassar, to study French poetry of all things, and allowed her to meet another scion of a rich family, that they got married, leveraged that class position into a high-powered career in intelligence, but at the expense of a happy family life, and then she wrote poetry about it. I could see some of my listeners being like, yeah, okay, that's cool, Jimmy. But things are never that simple on Program to Chill. While I do think that the specifics of these things are interesting and telling, and while I think that the devil is in the details, there's still more that I'm getting to, because I was holding back from you, dear listeners, just as I didn't tell you that it was Cicely Angleton who wrote that dissertation. I didn't read the whole preface. Allow me to read the entire preface here now. This paper will treat the background of 12th century heresy in the South, the nature of the missions, and the appropriate sources in order to establish the effect of the missions on the counterinsurgency of the Church, resulting in the Albigensian Crusade and the Inquisition in the south of France. Again, this paper will treat the background of 12th century heresy in the South, the nature of the missions, and the appropriate sources, in order to establish the effect of the missions on the counterinsurgency of the Church, resulting in the Albigensian Crusade and the Inquisition in the south of France. Just one more time, rule of threes. In order to establish the effect of the missions on the counterinsurgency of the Church. So, you think it might be interesting that Cicely Angleton in particular, married to James Jesus Angleton, head of counterintelligence, might have a particular unique interest in historical instances of counterinsurgency? You think maybe the daughter of the mining baron who put down insurgencies might have an interest in counterinsurgency? Do you think her husband, who was all up and down counterinsurgency? This seems extremely relevant to me. The CIA was, of course, involved in counterinsurgency since its inception. Further, although yes, I have my doubts about the origins of the hippie movement, I don't know that I believe that any one group planned or invented it start to finish, right? And in some ways, the Cathars were sort of like the hippie insurgency cropping up all over the world in the 60s. You know, when you combine it, combine the hippies with the global new left, right? And the CIA, of course, helped control, mitigate, infiltrate, divert, and crush that movement. Do I think Cicely Angleton sat down and said intentionally, I am going to study the Cathars as counterinsurgency to have something to talk to my husband about? No, I don't. I think it grew out of a completely organic interest that the ruling class shares. But do I think that they talked about it? Absolutely. How could they not? I forget if I cited it, but I read in one of the, like, dozen books that I've read on this fucker that Angleton very much intellectually respected Sicily. I think I quoted a relative saying that. Granted, James Jesus Angleton was also not a lunch pail 9-to-5 type counterinsurgency guy. Like, no, he wasn't like one of those, you know, Pentagon types. No, he was a Ivy League counterintelligence guy. His entire approach was extremely intellectual, analytical, cryptic. The guy started out his career obsessed with literary criticism and only got weirder from there. So, like, would he be interested in weird medieval parallels to the shit that he was doing today? Yes, also, absolutely. 100%. But on top of that, as I established in the first Cathar episode, the people that were very into the Cathars hundreds of years later were fucking weirdos. Some were outright Nazis or their loose equivalents, like Vichy guys. Many were occultists, and all of them were on some weird esoteric shit. Is it surprising that Cicely D'Altremont Angleton, scion of satanic lawyers, bankers, and mine owners, lumber owners, who married a spook whose hands were literally covered in blood, is it a surprise that she would be drawn to the Cathars? I mean, it's surprising to find out that it's actually true. It's not surprising on a theoretical basis. Now, what did Cicely Angleton see in the Cathars? Why did she seem at the same time to be interested in counterinsurgency and, you know, how the Catholic Church put down the Cathars? The Inquisition and counterintelligence clearly have a lot of parallels. Why did Cicely call her summer abroad in southern France a pilgrimage? Her poetry had a darker side, and there are a few hints of her interest in Catharism in the poems. Was Cicely Angleton a neo-Cathar? Was James Jesus Angleton? For sources today, I use the book Cold Warrior by Tom Mangold, the book The Ghost by Jefferson Morley, the book Wilderness of Mirrors by David C. Martin, the book The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot, the book Of Moles and Mole Hunters, a review of counterintelligence literature 1977 to 1992 by the CIA itself, lol. Also, shout out as always to the Spartacus website, various articles of family history that I found, the Library of Congress podcast, the Book of Poetry, A Cave of Overwhelming by Cicely Angleton, obviously, the dissertation itself by Cicely Angleton. Shout out to James Jesus Angleton and Cicely Angleton's daughters, who I talked to. They were very pleasant. I wouldn't recommend talking to or harassing them in any way. Even though I'm talking mad shit on their parents. Also, shout out to Ezerak for letting me know about the dissertation, and Dr. Diocletian Blob for assisting me in acquiring it. Thank you for listening, my dear listeners. I need to be on my way. I am headed to a CIA safe house in Virginia. See you next episode, and God bless.
Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me, you irreplaceable you. Just one look at you, my heart grew tipsy in you and you alone. Bring out the gypsy in me. I love all the many charms about you, above all I want my arms about you, so don't you be a naughty baby. Come to Papa Do, my sweet embraceable you. Charms about you, above all I want these arms about you, so don't you be a naughty baby. Come to Papa Do, my sweet embraceable.